The Exchange Podcast is brought to you in part by the University System of New Hampshire in partnership with its four institutions around the state. Visit usnh.edu/yours to learn what you can accomplish here.
The Exchange Podcast also gets support from the New Hampshire Chiropractic Association, an organization of professionals providing a non-invasive, non-surgical approach to healthcare, tailoring treatment plans to meet individuals' needs. Learn more at nhchiropractic.org.
From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. That's the percentage of the state's population that has received at least a first dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. A little more than a third of the state's population is now fully vaccinated. And this comes as the state's safer at home guidelines are set to lapse tonight at midnight. Today on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, we'll take stock of where we are in the pandemic and reflect on a few other key headlines. And we welcome your thoughts. If you've got questions about COVID-19, now's the time to call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Use Facebook, tweet us, or email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And with us for this part of the program, Nancy West, executive editor of InDepthNH.org. Hey, Nancy, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Peter.
So let's start off by recapping some of the COVID-19 numbers that the state has been tracking since the beginning of the pandemic. Nancy, is there a trend worth noting when it comes to the number of new cases of COVID-19 in New Hampshire?
Well, I think they are trending down slightly. Officials yesterday said the cases averaging per day are now about between 200 and 250 new viruses reported every day. Last week, that was 300 to 350 cases a day. You know, they're still cautioning people that this is a transitionary period. We're not home free yet.
Mm-hmm. And what about hospitalizations and fatalities? Are those also trending downward?
Slightly, but still concerning. There's 88, as of yesterday, Thursday, there were 88 people in the hospital in New Hampshire for COVID, and three new deaths were reported. Now, only one of those was related to long-term care, but sadly, that's three more deaths, and that brings the total deaths in New Hampshire since the start of the pandemic to 1,311.
1,311 deaths total since the pandemic
began. And still, there's 1,849 people with active infections. So, as I said, we're not out of the woods yet.
Mm-hmm. So given that we're not out of the woods, what is state epidemiologist Benjamin Chan saying about how people should behave? He's been consistent in saying that, you know, even though vaccines are rolling out, it's still a good idea to wear your mask in public and avoid big crowds and maintain physical distancing. Is that still the line from state epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan?
Yeah, Dr. Chan has not wavered. He's very, very insistent that the way out of this pandemic is to continue the kind of behavior people have been doing for the last year. And that's wearing a mask, socially distancing from each other, and most importantly, getting vaccinated. Both he and Dr. Daley and Governor Sununu really want people to get on board and get vaccinated. They say that's how we're going to really get to the end of this road.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about money for a little bit, because this was a subject of conversation at the press conference yesterday. Governor Sununu at the press conference talked a bit about the American Rescue Plan money and how he says the state lacks guidance from the federal government on how to spend it. Can you walk us through the governor's complaint about federal guidance?
Yeah, the state is expecting to receive half of its allotted $1 billion in the next week. There's another $450 million earmarked for municipalities and counties. And Governor Sununu said he has heard not one word from the federal government about how the state can spend that money. He's got some ideas,
Did he elaborate on those ideas?
Yes, but not really in dollar amounts, but he's really expecting to do a lot of infrastructure work with those dollars. He wants to expand broadband. He wants to work on cleaning up the state's drinking water, mental health services. And he was talking not just about services, but about the need for beds, the needs for community services. And, you know, that has borne out in so many news stories this year, with people waiting in the hospital emergency rooms for psychiatric beds. And he also wants to work on, he says there's been a lot of neglect of the state parks, and he wants to get on that and really put some money there. Also, he wants to put some of this money in the hotel and lodging industry and for small businesses, even if they didn't lose revenue during the pandemic. He wants to get money out on the streets to these businesses, small businesses, as soon as possible.
And speaking of small businesses, he was also talking a little bit about how the state or some of these businesses in the state, anticipating a loss of revenue, took some grant money from the state, but the businesses may have done better than expected, and they didn't lose money, so they may have to return that. Can you spell out the details of that particular part of the press conference?
Yeah, he said there could be as much as $50 million that could be recouped by the state. Now, Governor Sununu really said he was not interested in recouping that money, but was required to do so because of the strings attached to the Federal CARES Act. Now, that one of the reporters brought up, disputed that fact and said he had received differing information from the federal government. But Sununu was adamant that the rules say that businesses that didn't end up losing money were required to bring that money back. But when if the state does end up recouping that money, he wants to send it back out on the streets to small businesses, even if they didn't lose money during the pandemic. He says that, and it makes sense, that many of these small businesses had a lot of extra money that they had to spend, you know, on pandemic related items. So he wants to get, if that is in fact what's going to happen, but even without that 50 million, there's another 1 billion from the latest round of federal funds that the governor is already planning on spending. And as I mentioned before, it's going to largely go to infrastructure items. So there's going to be a lot of money coming into the state again to make up for what's happened. Although Governor Sununu is so bullish on the economy here, he said more businesses went out of business in 2019 than did in 2020. So that's, you know, that's quite a feat, especially during a pandemic.
Yeah, it's not what you might have expected, right? Given all the rhetoric we've heard about businesses closing, they're temporary closures.
Well, and I think some businesses were hit harder than others, and that's been borne out. The restaurant industry, the hotel industry, in fact, lodging and hotel businesses in New Hampshire, that's one area that the governor also wants to get money to. They were left out, apparently, of a federal program that helped restaurants. So he would like to see the restaurants and the hotel and lodging industry, you know, get some benefit from this funding.
Well, listeners, we'd love to hear from you on this or on anything related to COVID-19. Are you a business owner who received one of these grants and now you might have to return that money? Are you impacted in any way by the lifting of the Safer at Home order? Give us a call now. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. So governor seems pretty bullish on the state economy. The economy seems like it might benefit somewhat, though you tell me, Nancy West, from the lifting of the Safer at Home order. Can you give us a reminder of what the lifting of the Safer at Home order means?
Well, there's going to be a lot going on. As of midnight tonight, businesses are not going to be held under the strict guidances that the state had put out before relative to how many people could be at a table in a restaurant, what percentage of patrons a venue could have. That's going to be, as of midnight tonight, that most of that is going to be up to the individual businesses. So it's going to be interesting to see how people respond. And I think some of the businesses are already talking about easing into this, not doing anything drastic, and to continue doing what they're doing as far as requiring masks. Now, as you know, Governor Sununu has lifted the mask mandate for New Hampshire, but many businesses and still some communities are requiring mask wearing. So it's going to be interesting to see both how people respond and what different businesses do.
You said some businesses might be phasing in the lifting of the restrictions, even though the state's no longer requiring them?
Yeah, I don't think it's something. I think they want to make sure that their patrons feel safe and comfortable, that there's no drastic change, that they have to stop wearing the mask. This is behavior that people have been doing for a long time here in New Hampshire, and they want to make sure people feel comfortable and safe.
Mm-hmm.
Especially people, you know, some people have already made reservations for certain programs that they want to go to under the impression that there would be social distancing. So I believe those will be continued to be honored. But it's good. I think it'll be gradual for the most part, but it is definitely becoming way more flexible and opening up in New Hampshire.
And is that due in part to just the rising vaccination rates?
Well, I think it's data-driven, according to the governor. So I don't think that's the only factor, but I think they look at, you know, community spread, different things. I've talked to some health experts that say, you know, there's still some communities in the state. And actually, Dr. Ben Chan said at the press conference that there are still some communities in the state with high rates of COVID. So I think that plays a lot of role into what decisions the governor makes. But however opened up it is, the governor, Beth Daly, Dr. Daly, and Dr. Chan all recommend continuing the behavior that people have been doing. So I think there might be a bit of a mixed message there, but the scientists say, keep wearing masks, keep socially distancing, and get vaccinated. That's the message from the state.
Well, listeners, if you've got questions about COVID-19 and COVID-19 policy in New Hampshire, now's the time to call. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Randy in Manchester. Randy, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just kind of curious. We get that $50 million or so that was supposed to maybe come back to help businesses or whatever. Maybe that could go to helping the homeless in some way. I mean, there's a lot of homeless out there I've been seeing. And I know they have a hard time finding places to sleep. Maybe some of that $50 million that the businesses that he wants to maybe put back to businesses, maybe he could do something with that to help the homeless.
Well,
something that they're thinking about.
Thank you, Randy. We really appreciate your comments, Randy. And Nancy West, to you, have you heard anything about the state using some kind of aid money, whether it's from the American Rescue Package or some other package to help New Hampshire's homeless population?
No, I haven't, but I'm sure that some of the governor's staff listen to this program. So, Randy, I'm going to make sure that I ask the governor the question, is any of this money going to be earmarked for homeless people? I know that has been a major problem in the state. Thank you so much for that.
Really appreciate the call, Randy. Thanks very much. On the subject of vaccines, again, Nancy, I'm sure parents are wondering, any updates on when kids between the ages of 12 and 15 might be able to get vaccinated?
Actually, Dr. Daly said yesterday that they're already working on the program to vaccinate 12 to 15-year-olds in New Hampshire, and they're waiting for the FDA approval for that age group to use the vaccine. I believe it's the Pfizer vaccine, and it sounded like they're ready to go as soon as that approval comes.
Okay.
So I'm expecting it to be very soon. I have a 12-year-old grandson, and his pediatrician is suggesting strongly that that 12 to 15-year-olds be vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. They may be coming into contact with a lot of other 12 to 15-year-olds as the summer opens up the world and kids are out there playing in parks and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be great.
Yeah. What about the J&J vaccine? I've heard the state is continuing mass vaccinations using the J&J vaccine and will be for the rest of this month.
Yes, and actually I'm glad you brought that up because we should remind people that every Saturday in May from 1 to 6 at sites in Nashua, Newington, Salem, and Concord, they can register to get the vaccine. And that's I think that's largely for people who possibly work during the week and weren't able to make to register to get the vaccine. So from 1 to 6 every Saturday in May, that's available. Now to register, people can go to vaccines.nh.gov, and the website walks people through. Now for people who don't use the internet, they can call 211. I know there's many appointments available. So I hope people will register.
And those two things are when we refer to Vinny or when the governor refers to Vinny, that's Vinny.
That's where they'll find Vinny. That's the state-created website that will be much easier than the old federal system. So it's supposed to be much, much easier.
Mm-hmm. And so the J&J vaccine used to be very popular. It's a one-and-done shot. You just need one dose of it. Then it was paused by the federal government after few reports of blood clots. After an investigation, that pause was lifted. It's been deemed safe again. Have feelings in New Hampshire about the J&J vaccine noticeably changed since that pause in administering it last month?
Well, I did hear that there were fewer takers for the last mass vaccination site. So I think there has been some reluctance. But now that the federal government has signed off and approved the use as safe, I think you'll see more people wanting to do the one and done. They only need it's only one dose that's required. And I think there was some reluctance, and we'll have to wait and see if that continues.
All right. Well, just a reminder, too, we'll have the state epidemiologists, Dr. Benjamin Chan and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, on the show next Wednesday. So listeners, if you've got questions, you can ask them now. But of course, they're the experts as well. So feel free to dial in to that program. Give us a call and put your question directly to them. That's, again, on The Exchange on Wednesday here on NHPR. Let's go to the phones again. Oh, I apologize. That's next Thursday's show. Forgive me. The top epidemiologists on the show on Thursday. And Nancy, I wanted to ask you about folks completing their second shots. We said at the top of the program, right, that 53% of the state has had at least one dose, a little more than a third of the state's fully vaccinated. So there might be some folks out there in between doses.
Yes, could be.
And is there an effort on the state's part to remind people like, hey, you got to get your second shot?
Oh, I think there's a massive campaign out there to remind people, to remind everybody of not only getting their second shot, but to get vaccinated. There's a very large advertising campaign. I'm sure that people have run into it on TV or on the internet. And yes, that's important for people to remember to get their second shot. I believe, especially through the VINI system, when people signed up for their first shot, they automatically were given a date for their second shot. So I don't think that's the same problem that it was in the old VAM system.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones again and talk to Francilia. Francilia in Hancock, thank you very much for giving us a call. What's on your mind?
Yes, thanks. I'm here. I understand that as of last week, about 50 people in New Hampshire who had been vaccinated for COVID-19 yet came down with it. And it seems to me it would be really useful to know, what is that population? What do you know about them? Were they old, young, et cetera, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Good question. I'll put that to you, Nancy West. Did you hear about this as well, Francilia?
Yes, we've reported on this, and it was something that I'm told that was expected, because none of the vaccines is perfect. None is 100%. So what they're called is breakthrough cases, and normally they're expected to be less serious cases of COVID-19. And the last figure I got from the state was it's over 100 people. I think it was 117 people have experienced this breakthrough virus after being fully vaccinated. And there have been 2 deaths of people who were fully vaccinated, according to the state. And that's so sad that 2 people were fully vaccinated and died. But the majority are going to have a much less serious case if and when this does occur. And I'm told by the state that this is not just one age group or one area of the state, that it's across all age groups, all races and ethnicities, and it's not something that the state has really been able to pinpoint to any specific reasoning behind it.
I see.
But so they are tracking it very closely, as they are at the federal level. This is something that's sort of just emerging, so there's not all that much known about it yet.
Well, thank you for the question. Good to know that the state is both tracking it and is not necessarily finding any kind of common factor that would cause the vaccine to fail among a certain group of people in this way. Worth noting that the at least for the Pfizer vaccine, and I believe it was was pretty high for Moderna as well, but 95 to 100% effective in preventing serious illness, not necessarily going to prevent any illness, but preventing serious illness. Let's go to the phones again while we have some time. And I think we have Sharon now. Sharon, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank
Great
you.
To hear from you, Sharon. What's on your mind?
I have a question about the immunity that results from the vaccine. I would not have had the vaccine. I've had both of mine, and I'm still wearing masks. But the question I have is, people who've had the COVID-19 have oftentimes, we've assumed they were immune, and they get a second, I'm not sure if they're getting any more than that, but they get a second case. And I don't know if it's a less intense, less dangerous case for them, or if it's the same as the first case they got, but they're not getting a natural immunity, which we normally expect from getting a disease, or we get a flu vaccine, so we don't get it, but if we get it, we are immune then. So I guess I don't understand, and I haven't heard enough coverage about how the two immunities compare and why one is more, maybe the Pfizer is more effective than the other vaccines, but I'd like to know more about that.
Thank you very much for the question, Sharon. What do you think, Nancy West?
According to the state, they hadn't determined one vaccine over the other was more important in, preventing the second round of breakthrough virus. But the numbers are still very small. And as I mentioned, this is still being researched, not a lot known yet about it. But those are very good questions, and I'm sure more will be revealed.
Well, again, a good time to plug Thursday's show next week. Dr. Benjamin Chan and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot will be on the program to answer questions just like yours, Sharon. Forgive us if we haven't had the right information for you today, but we do appreciate the question. So Nancy West of InDepthNH.org, what are you going to be reporting on within the next week or so with respect to COVID-19?
Well, you know, I'm glad that Sharon brought up that question about breakthrough cases. I think we will focus on that. I'm also interested in whether or not businesses will indeed have to repay money if they didn't incur losses here in New Hampshire. So, and it never ends with COVID. There's always new questions that emerge. And as you know, I'll be tuning in to Thursday's show to see what Dr. Chan has to say.
Well, Nancy West, we really appreciate you being on the program today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Peter. Always a pleasure.
That's Nancy West, executive editor of InDepthNH.org. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, it's all about the state budget. The next two-year spending plan includes tax cuts, a proposal to create a State Department of Energy, and a body camera fund for police, and so much more. We hope to break it down with Ethan DeWitt after a break, but we want to also hear from you. What part of the budget are you closely watching? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for tuning in. State lawmakers are working on the next two-year spending plan, which contains a variety of proposals, including some tax cuts. Reporter Ethan DeWitt of the New Hampshire Bulletin has been reporting on this, and he's with us now. Welcome, Ethan.
Happy to be here, Peter.
And listeners, you are invited to join this conversation, of course. Tell us what you think of the tax cuts or any other part of the budget that you are interested in. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Ethan DeWitt, marathon session going into the late night. That's often the case around budget time, but this year was no different, except, of course, virtual for COVID reasons. Ethan, remind us how the budget process works in New Hampshire.
Sure. So there's three parties to keep in mind when you're looking at the New Hampshire budget. You've got the governor, and the governor kicks off the process. The governor, first of all, the budget lasts for 2 years. And so every odd numbered year, which is essentially every year after the election, every odd numbered year, the budget has to come up, and the governor kicks it off by hearing from his departments. They kind of present what they think they need for that 2 years. Then the governor in the February of the budget year will come out with a speech that he gives to the legislature. And then the process moves over to the House. So it goes from the governor to the House to the Senate. The House has roughly about a month to hold hearings and come up with their version. They can change whatever they want to the governor's budget. They can change the amount that is spent. They can change some of the policy provisions. Then they pass it to the Senate. That's where it is right now. So the Senate is in its early stages at the moment. The Senate has until the end of this month, essentially June 3rd, to pass. So they have a committee that will be meeting nearly daily in the next few weeks, and will then pass it back to the House. And at that point, that's where it hits its critical stage. The budget affects the year, the state fiscal year, which begins July 1st. So the whole budget has to be finalized by the end of June. And that's where we kind of see the crunch time in any year where there's intense negotiations between those three parties, what the governor originally wanted, what the House changed, and what the Senate also changed. They have to stitch that together into something that the governor can ultimately sign.
And that is democracy in action. And we're going to talk a little bit about those changes and where they may land up. But I did want to ask you, Ethan, how much is this budget and how does it compare to previous budgets?
So it's about $13 billion, and that's kind of been, when it comes to spending levels, it's been about where it has been before. There was an analysis by the Josiah Bartlett Center that looked at how much the House spent versus the governor's spent, proposed budget in both of their proposed budgets. The House was not that far off from what Sununu, Governor Sununu, has proposed earlier this year. It's only about $50 million less. If you compare this budget to the budget that was in place 2 years ago, there is a decrease. The House would actually institute a 1.4% decrease over what we had the year before. Generally, the budgets increase in spending, so that's notable. And one thing that's kind of happening here is that there was a hiring freeze last year. And so a lot of the money that was appropriated for the last year during COVID simply wasn't spent by a lot of the departments. You also had a lot of federal CARES Act money coming in. So that kind of buoyed the state. And so lawmakers this year, particularly Republican lawmakers in the House, are seeking to use that and kind of looking at that cushion that the state has got from the CARES Act and from other congressional aid packages, and saying, well, we can go into this next year a little bit leaner than we would have before, especially with uncertainty. But that might change. The one thing about the budget process is that it's a moving target for all parties, because the business taxes, and you know, everybody pays taxes generally in April, that business is no exception. So the business tax revenues are finalized in April, and they have just come in this week, much above what they were thought to. So there's a lot more money to use, and depending on your political ideology, you can use that in different ways. But because the amount of money that is being raised continually changes, the budget also changes. So the budget that you see in February often is much different when you finally get to June.
Now, is it that the Senate has access to those numbers that you were just speaking of, that the House, when it was making its version of the budget, did not have access to?
Yes, and that's the case every single budget, and that is why the process begins to intensify no matter who the political parties are when you get into May, as we are, and into June, because you're getting final numbers and you're getting an actual, a much fuller picture of what you have to spend. There's often a lot more money that the Senate has available to it that the House didn't have. So that's where you get those kinds of negotiations, and that's where kind of these conversations start.
Well, the budget seemed to have started with Governor Sununu's desire to lower the business tax rates. And it seemed like the House Republicans concurred with that. Where are we now with respect to reducing business taxes?
So this is I should say, the big theme, just to kind of start this out, the big theme this year is exactly how the Senate is going to bridge what have become very notable differences between the House and the governor on what they want. Everybody's in the same party here. Republicans took back the state House last November. Sununu is a Republican himself, but their visions are very different. So we kind of, in that context, that's kind of the what I think every reporter is kind of looking at, is how the House kind of has a much different idea for which programs it thinks are necessary. And the House actually took out a lot of what the governor had put in. One thing that everybody is in agreement on, though, is business tax reductions. That's something that Sununu, I asked him on election night last year what he's looking forward to next year. And that was the first thing that he said, was reducing the business taxes. Right now, there's something called the business profits tax, and it's set at 7.7%. About 5 years ago, that was at 8.5%. It's been gradually reduced. Democrats have opposed reducing it. They say it's unnecessary, and that businesses aren't asking for it. Republicans say this is the way that you stimulate the economy in New Hampshire, and they pointed to high business tax revenues to say that we've been reducing this and it hasn't affected us. But that's something that all the House, Senate, and governor are on the same page with.
Listeners, we're speaking with Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the New Hampshire Bulletin, about the state budget. Your questions about it are welcome. Email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. But the quickest way to get your question to Ethan is to give us a call now. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Ethan, you mentioned some differences between what the governor wanted to spend money on and what the House thought was appropriate to spend money on. What among those differences stands out to you?
Sure. I think the best way to start explaining this is there's two pieces of the budget. there's the spending part, which is the line item part. That's, you know, that bill is usually over 1,000 pages. It makes for very difficult reading. And that's kind of, here's what every single department gets. Here's what every single agency within that department gets. Here's what every single employee gets. Then you have a second bill that, so that's generally called House Bill 1. The second bill is called House Bill 2. That is the policy bill. And the intent of that is, if you're going to create new programs that have spending and you're going to appropriate money to pay for positions, you need to have some policy that explains what you're doing. You can't just throw money around. But what it has always also been is kind of a catch-all omnibus for any sort of policy projects that the governor might want to add in. The governor isn't a legislator. So every 2 years, the governor gets a chance to add whatever he or she deems important in terms of policy. And that's where you get some of the more interesting disputes this year. Like I said, there's not a lot of daylight right now between what the governor has proposed and what the House has proposed. There is significant difference between what the House has proposed, what the governor's proposed for policy, what the House has. So some examples, the governor has a paid family leave plan. This has been kind of an ongoing clash between Democrats and this governor. This was a theme of the last two Democratic gubernatorial candidates. The governor has a voluntary plan. Democrats argue you need a mandatory plan to make it financially work. So he put his voluntary plan in this budget. He also has a long-running bipartisan plan to build a psychiatric hospital, which would help with wait times and kind of eliminate the secure unit in the prison. And he has a college debt forgiveness plan that he's been talking about for years. These are big priorities for the governor. He also had another plan to merge the university system with the community college system, which was also a very big initiative. He announced all these things, Governor Sununu, in a speech in February. And again, he's speaking to a Republican legislature. So you would think in normal times that this would be, he'd be kind of preaching in the choir and the wheels would be greased for these kinds of initiatives. But the House this year has taken kind of quite a big axe to a lot of those. They've taken out the psychiatric hospital, they've taken out the college debt forgiveness program, they've taken out the paid family leave plan, and then they've added things that the governor has said he either opposes or are complete non-starters, one of which you've probably heard of is the divisive concepts bill, and another is a provision that would target funding for Planned Parenthood and reproductive health centers. So the House has added these provisions that some have called poison pills into the budget, and there's a standoff kind of brewing on the horizon over how those get resolved. And yeah. So that's when I say everyone's looking at the Senate, it's the Senate's game now, but next month it'll be all parties involved. And so pretty much every move every day is crucial.
Yeah, well, let me ask you before we get into divisive concepts and Planned Parenthood, what are the chances the Senate is inclined to reinstate some of those things like the college education provision that Sununu included and the House ripped out? Is the Senate inclined to put those back in?
It's really hard to tell this early on. The Senate process right now is so early on. What they've been doing is the last few weeks, they've been hearing from agencies and they've been very neutral, just asking agencies, well, what do you want? And this week they had that notable, what you had mentioned, that very late hearing, which is a hearing from the public. And that allowed kind of anybody to speak. And that went until 10:30 PM. So far the senators haven't really showed their cards yet. But the way it typically works is it sort of becomes a little bit of a horse trading game, where once you get to the end, everybody has their priorities and everybody kind of stakes out, here's what I can live with losing and here's what I absolutely need. And then they try to meet in the middle. What has been notable this year is just the kind of aggressiveness with which the House, which again is the same party, has attempted to insert itself into this process. I wrote a story a few weeks ago about how the House budget chairman, Ken Wyler, who's been in the House for a long time, he wrote a very unusual email to the Senate just as the budget was being passed over to the Senate. And he said, you guys can do whatever you want with this bill, but here are our four priorities, and if you don't keep those that we've added, these changes, then we can't see our side passing this bill. And most of those priorities are anathema to a lot of what the governor has said. So that this was the House kind of planting a flag in the ground and saying, these are what we're going to fight about. And some of them are limiting the governor's emergency powers. One of them is that divisive concepts bill. And so this is, we're kind of primed for, I'm trying not to hyperbolize, but we are primed for a pretty dramatic next few weeks if the House stands by what they've said.
Mm-hmm. The divisive concepts bill in particular was known as HB 544. It caused a stir in part because some say it would limit the ability of schools and other state contractors to discuss things like systemic racism. What is the dialogue about this been in the Senate so far?
Well, again, this is something that is, I think, there are some very intense conversations happening on the Republican side in the Senate right now. And I think you have a governor who's been very vocal in press conferences about how not only does he oppose this, not only does he believe this is a violation of freedom of speech, but that he would veto any budget that would include that. And that would be pretty remarkable move, vetoing a budget again from his own party. So now you have the Senate, which has always, especially in recent years, has hewed closer to this governor. The Republican Senate President Chuck Morse in the past has often kind of helped the governor with his priorities when they were last in power. So they have some difficult decisions. They're going to be kind of working within their own caucus to see what they can do. We don't know what they're thinking. We do know what happened at the hearing this week, which was, again, an open forum. Anybody could speak. And almost every speaker brought up the divisive concepts bill and was opposed to it. A lot of them were individuals, but some of them represented organizations. So you had representatives of schools who said that this would kind of prevent any kind of nuanced instruction on history. And you also had some organizations who were worried about workplace anti-bias trainings that they had set up. You had a spokesman for the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center who said that it would kind of dismantle a lot of the progress that hospital has made to try to kind of tackle this issue, particularly in the wake of kind of the movements last summer, the Black Lives Matter movements and the George Floyd protests. So there has been a lot of opposition vocalized during the hearing, and what remains to be seen is what the Senate, which is now being kind of caught in a vice between the House, the governor, and those people testifying, what they ultimately decide.
Ethan, before we let you go, I want to pose a question to you that a listener wants us to ask, and that's with respect to money for homeless populations, for substance abuse and behavioral health. What does the budget have to offer people suffering from those issues?
To be very honest, I don't know if there's a program in there. I haven't seen anything kind of come on the kind of top line items to the fore, but there might be something in there. I would say probably there doesn't seem to be anything particularly new in that area from what I've seen.
Well, I'm sure reporting on this is going to continue, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again. Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the New Hampshire Bulletin, thank you very much for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll check in on some North Country news, in particular, a national story with local implications. President Biden is pushing to end the country's reliance on for-profit prisons. And that means, in this case, about 200 people are being moved from a prison in Texas to the federal prison in Berlin. That's just one of the stories we'll discuss after a quick break. If you've got comments on this or on other stories on your mind, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email if you'd like. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Stay with us. Welcome back to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Right now, we are putting the news of the week in context for you on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're so glad you can make it today. And with us now is Barbara Tatro, editor of the Berlin Sun. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Let's start with what I mentioned, that national story with local implications. President Biden pushing to end the country's reliance on for-profit prison populations. That means the federal prison in Berlin is taking in about 200 people. Listeners, we'd love to hear your opinion on this move, too. 1-800-892-6477. And Barbara, what does this mean for the Federal Correctional Institute in Berlin?
Well, it certainly has the capacity to absorb these inmates. The prison, since it's been open about 10 years, has never, ever even approached really half its capacity. It was built for 1,150 minimum security inmates and 128. And today, with, I presume, most of the 200 inmates there, it has 840 inmates. So it certainly has capacity. And on some level, I guess, it makes sense to use a prison that you've just built recently rather than using a private prison. Mm-hmm. But the issue, I think, is staffing.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how many more staff members will the federal prison need?
Well, I asked him about staffing, and the answer I got was, we're always trying to hire staff. So I don't know how many staff members they have up there. Mm-hmm. But I've heard that in the prison system overall, nationally, they have staffing problems because during the Trump administration, they cut staff by 12%. So in some prisons, and I've heard that it happens here, they've had to press cooks, custodians, maintenance people into correctional positions. So that's the issue, I guess, is there staffing to absorb this? And will there be additional staff coming on?
That's definitely a good question to follow for the answer in the coming months. The prison recently experienced a COVID-19 outbreak. More than 170 inmates tested positive for COVID-19. Barbara, what's the situation there now?
Well, they're down. I looked those numbers up. They got two inmates and three staff testing positive. So in 3 weeks' time, they pretty much got it under control.
All right. So are you planning on reporting more on this issue in the coming weeks?
We will. We will try and see what the impact is in the community. You know, the reaction I heard in the community was, well, this will be more money circulating through the community, more jobs, more payroll. You know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of negative reaction to the federal prison here, largely because people have limited interaction with it. It sits out of town, up on a hill. You can't even access it from the road. There's a gate right at the bottom of it. So it's sort of like out of sight. And the inmates who work there, not the inmates, the people who work there tend to shift in and out of the community. If you're upward mobile, you want to advance in the system, you have to transfer. So they come, they stay a couple of years. Sometimes they buy property, sometimes they rent. And then for a lot of them, 2 or 3 years, 4 years down the road, they've moved on to another prison as they advance in their career.
Well, let me ask you about another story pertaining to the northern part of the state, Barbara Tatro. The truck driver in the Randolph crash that killed 7 motorcyclists in June of 2019, he's appealed to the state Supreme Court after his motion for a bail hearing was denied for a third time in Coos County Superior Court. Remind us about the Vladimir Zhukovsky trial and what's going on with that. He was charged with what exactly?
He's been charged with 7 counts of negligent homicide, 7 counts of negligent homicide while driving under the influence, and 7 counts of manslaughter. Obviously, some of those are alternate counts, and 1 count of reckless conduct. Mm-hmm. He's asking, basically, he's being held under preventive detention. He's asking for a bail hearing on the issue of bail. And, you know, the local judge has denied his request for a bail hearing 3 times. So they're asking the state Supreme Court to order a bail hearing.
I see. Have the judges or judge issued a reason for why he was denied bail?
He generally agrees with the state, and the state is arguing that he's a danger to himself and the public, that he was on suspension and driving without a license when the accident occurred, that he's admitted that he admitted that he was on drugs when he was driving, and that you know, he's on here, he's here on a permanent residency visa, but that he has family members in the Ukraine, and that he presents a significant flight risk.
I see. So what's supposed to happen next?
Well, the trial is scheduled for November, late November, and the defense is trying to move that up to mid-November. So I assume they're still doing discovery in the case. They found a bunch of emails that the state is turning over to the defense, and the defense still has an expert witness that hasn't presented its foot report. As far as I know, they haven't done, this defense has not done depositions in the case yet. Okay. They're waiting for all the expert testimony.
All right.
The testimony is, I don't know if you remember this, but they just recently re-indicted him and eliminated from the indictments the words that the defendant, Zukowski, crossed the center line. Because that now appears that both the motorcycle and the truck were sort of on that center line. And the debate has been whose vehicle crossed the center line. And the state's expert witness now has indicated that it may actually have been a motorcycle that went into the middle line. And they've also, you know, determined that the lead motorcycle driver's blood tested over the legal limit for alcohol.
I see. So that certainly complicates the case. So trial in November, we'll keep an eye on that. It's been of great interest to people here in New Hampshire, not just in the North Country as well. Barbara, before we let you go, really quickly, I do want to get your take on the trial of former State Senator Jeff Woodburn, scheduled to begin Monday in Coos County. He's pleaded not guilty to 2 counts of domestic violence and 4 counts of simple assault, among other charges. Remind us, because it's been a long time since this story first emerged, what's this case about?
It's about a relationship gone bad, really. I mean, there's testimony in there that, you know, throwing clothes out on the lawn, kicking in doors. They were going for counseling. Jeff Woodburn was a very popular Democratic state senator. The alleged victim, his fiance at the time, was head of the Coos County Democratic Party and was running for Coos County treasurer. They were like North Country Democratic power couple. And, you know, Jeff was rumored to be maybe in line to run for governor. And right before, they were marching in the 4th of July parade together in Gorham. And then a couple weeks later, the charges surfaced and Jeff was arrested. These charges are misdemeanors, which is unusual to have a trial in Superior Court. Normally they would be in district court, but because they figured the case would be appealed, they just decided to skip district court and go to Superior Court. But if Jeff Woodburn is convicted, he faces up to a year in jail on each count, each of the misdemeanor counts.
Very serious trial beginning on Monday. Barbara Tetreault, editor of the Berlin Sun, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And before we end the show today, I do want to brief you a little bit on some of the news that we've been following in the NHPR newsroom this week. The Grantham and Oyster River school districts are joining a lawsuit against the state of New Hampshire over education funding. The Conval lawsuit, named after the original plaintiff, the Conval School District sued the state in 2018, alleging that it was failing to fulfill its obligation to fund an adequate education for students. The case ended up in the state Supreme Court, but was sent back to the lower courts earlier this year. Now has 9 school districts as plaintiffs. In a press release yesterday, the Conval School District says it doesn't expect court hearings on the case for at least another year. And ending the show on a positive note, we used to end the show all the time with a little bit of animal news. Today, happy to say that there is a new feline prowling around the highest peak in the Northeast, Nimbus, a gray short hair who's sharing his name with large gray clouds that bring precipitation, has been a resident at the Mount Washington Observatory since April 14th. The observatory staff had a cat at the summit since 1932. Nimbus succeeds Marty, the black Maine Coon cat who died last fall. So everybody, welcome Nimbus to the Mount Washington Observatory. And that's it for the roundup today. But remember, all the stories that we discuss can be found at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer and news host Jessica Hunt. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. And I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.